Well, this is The Space Show, and we now have Angelo De Grazia, a member of the Space Association of Australia. And Angelo, could you tell us where you are at the moment?
Okay, how are you, Andrew? Good to be here. I'm currently in Titusville. I'm in a little unit not far from the Kennedy Space Centre, and really, I've just woken up in the wee hours of the morning to make this call to you and the listeners.
Yes, at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay, Angelo. Could you tell us what the SLS is?
Yes, I can. The SLS is part of the Artemis 1 project part of the Artemis program. It's the core vehicle that actually lofts the Orion capsule, which is the component that has the astronauts in it, that basically launches, is the rocket that launches the Orion to the moon. So Artemis is the Moon Mars Initiative of NASA, and the SLS, which stands for the Space Launch System, is the core booster that does the launching. It's derived from space shuttle components. It has its history that goes back to the early 2000s under George W. Bush. The Constellation program was envisaged to be a monster rocket, even bigger than the one that we've currently got, that was to get America back to the moon. But by 2010, it became obvious that there were a number of technical problems, but more importantly, the Constellation program ran over cost, and President Obama at the time then cancelled it in favour of commercial crew. However, the number of congressmen and lawmakers in America couldn't really put all its eggs in one basket, i.e. commercial space, and decided that it would basically tell NASA to build this new rocket that was made out of shuttle-derived parts, and it was basically on same cost-plus type contracts going to the same contractors. Unfortunately, that resulted in what we now see as the Space Launch System. I hope that gives a little bit of background, Andrew.
So it looks like the acronym SLS might well stand for the Senate Launch System.
Well, look, the idea was that it would be a backup to commercial space, because in those early days, no one really knew if commercial space was going to succeed, but also, you know, people have criticised it for being job for the boys. Now, you know, it's the old problem, you know. Yes, it costs a lot of money and they spend billions of dollars. Like I heard an estimate yesterday that the whole SLS system up until 2025 is going to cost something like about $95 billion, which is a staggering, you know, eye-watering amount. However, you know, where is the money spent? The money is spent here in America. It's spent on people, and people, you know, have families and have, and the money goes into the economy. So, you know, it was a way that the government gets money into the economy. So you can't begrudge the Americans for that. But nevertheless, NASA only gets a $26 billion budget per year. So something that's very expensive becomes very unsustainable. Anyway,
now many people are familiar with the Guy Fawkes rockets, or the ones we see on New Year's Eve, which are powered by gunpowder. What fuel and what oxidizer does the Space Launch System use?
Okay, the Space Launch System, as I said, is a derivative of the space shuttle, and they use liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, and now that is part of the problems that we were encountered in the last two launch attempts that we saw. So hydrogen being the lightest element in the world, has to find a very small crack and it will leak. We saw it in the shuttle, and we have now seen it quite dramatically in the SLS launch attempts.
Because they've been using hydrogen in rockets ever since the Centaur in 1960.
Yes, they have. And interestingly enough, if you go back, you'll find that they've had problems ever since the 1960s. It's part of the reason why people like Elon Musk, have decided that they're going to move to methane, because liquid hydrogen is a problem because it has to be chilled to such low temperatures. It has to be stored. It is susceptible to leaking because it is a very small molecule in hydrogen. Modern rockets tend to stay away from these liquid cryogenic type fuels, even though in a specific impulse aspect, hydrogen is the most efficient of fuels. It is. That's on the plus side. On the negative side, there's many more concerns with it. So that's the problem with hydrogen.
So what exactly went wrong on the first launch attempt on Monday, a week ago?
Okay, we, as you know, Andrew, I was there at the media centre, and we were watching this blow-by-blow very early in the morning. I think we left. I left home about midnight. For an 8 o'clock in the morning launch, 8:30, I think the window opened for a two-hour window. And we got there, and things were going okay in the early parts of the morning. But then as they started to fill the rocket, there were some anomalies, i.e. there was some small hydrogen leaks. So that was the first thing. But there were other things that were also of concern, like there was some insulation in the upper part of the rocket, and they didn't know whether they had a crack in the shell, or they had some just ice forming into the crack. It turns out that they were insignificant. Another problem then cropped up where... What they do is they do a chill down of the engines. They condition them before they, ignite them. So they run liquid hydrogen through them, and that chills them down. And what they found was that on one of the engines, engine 3, it had not chilled down sufficiently to allow them to launch. At the end... with about 40 minutes to spare before launch, they decided to pull the pin on the launch scrub because engine 3 hadn't reached the temperature. Now they were running behind in the launch window because there was some lightning in the morning, and that meant that they couldn't start fueling till later in the morning, which meant that they were eating into their launch window. So by the time they got this problem with the engine chill, number 3, they'd really run out of launch window, and they then decided to... Charlie, who's the female director now, launch director, made the call to scrub for the day. So that was a disappointment for everyone, but, the old adage, rather be safe than sorry. That problem, incidentally... smelt to me at the time of a sensor, and it wasn't until later that I think NASA really started to focus that yes, there is potentially a sensor problem, because they had other indicators that the pressure was okay, the flow rates were okay. It was just that the temperature was reading as an anomaly. So they then decided to basically restructure its procedures so that when they had another launch attempt, they could work around it and, maybe ignore that sensor. They can't access that rocket on the pad. It's not like the good old shuttle days or the Apollo days where you had a service structure that you could just roll in and... get into the rocket and do things. On this particular rocket, I suspect probably to do with cost, you really can't access this thing on the pad, and it makes it really, really difficult to fix things like sensors and other things. Now, even if you did access it on the pad, you might still have difficulty depending where the sensor is. But that was the problem on the first launch attempt. So that was the scrub for the day.
You must have been pretty disappointed then.
I was, you know, travelling, you know, all that way from Melbourne, Australia, to the other side of the world, might as well have been to the moon. To watch it scrub was disappointing, but you know, you've got to accept these things. And I had planned my trip so that I could cover the whole launch window. And as you know, the launch window went from the 29th of August all the way to the 5th of September. So I thought, well, you've got 3 launch attempts and a few sub attempts in between that you can achieve a successful mission. You know, we should be able to go on one of those. That was my thinking. And it turned out that I was wrong.
Well, where to from here for the Space Launch System?
Oh, I should mention what happened on the second launch attempt. Sorry, Andrew, very quickly. The second launch attempt occurred. They had another go a few days later. This time, they had a leak, a significant leak in the hydrogen, and it started off as a minor leak, and they went into manual fill, it's called, because normally these things are all automated. But if the automation still doesn't solve the problem, they go to manual. So they tried the manual fill, and here's my suspicion. When they did this, someone must have pressed the wrong button, and essentially one of the events was an over-pressurisation of the quick disconnect system that fills the rocket. And after that, all their attempts to seal the hydrogen leak really failed. And, you know, 2 hours before launch, again, Charlie made the call to scrub the launch. And the decision on that day was, let's decide what we're going to do, which leads us into where to from here, Andrew. At the moment, as I'm standing here, the decision is that they're going to try to fix the quick disconnect and the seal fueling the rocket on the pad. Now, it's complicated because you've got to get access to it. You've got to build a little structure around the quick disconnect system, so that you don't have any outside environmental impacts, like you know, a lot of salty air that is around Kennedy Space Centre, and things like rain and thunder and all the rest of it. Now, why are they doing this? The reason is that they can first diagnose what went wrong, because they can pull the quick disconnect slowly, and then assess what rubber seals that they have and other sealing devices to see what actually has gone wrong. And the other reason is that once they fix it, they can do a full cryogenic test of that component. In other words, fill up the hydrogen tank with maybe 10% hydrogen and then test the seal, you know, work it through its paces. These leaks on quick disconnect, when you're dealing with hydrogen, are not uncommon. Happened a number of times on shuttle, and a number of times shuttle had to go back to the vertical assembly building for repairs. But on this instance, I'll fix that. However, here's the cruncher. They'll be able to test it on the pad, but they won't be able to fire it. And the reason why they won't be able to fire it is because of what's called the flight termination system. What the flight termination system is, it's basically high explosives in the rocket that, should it veer off course, they press a button and the rocket blows up. But it relies on batteries. Now, in order to get this launch window in, NASA had to convince the Space Force, who are in control of safety at the Kennedy Space Center, that the 20-day limit approval should be extended to 25. They gave that to NASA. However, the flight termination, it is very unlikely that they will get an extension to maybe 35, 40 days. So, and the reason for that is the batteries. They need to qualify that the batteries are of sufficient power and strength and charge to blow up the rocket in case of an emergency. So, in order to do that, option A is to convince Space Force. It is pretty unlikely they'll get an extension. Option B is you roll it back to the VAV, vertical assembly building, and you recertify that system. And that is what they're going to have to do. As soon as they do that, it's going to take considerable time. There are two launch windows coming up, late September, and then there is the early October and late October timeframes. Late September they can't do. They just won't have the time for it to roll back, fix all the problems and come back. And the early October they can't do because they've got crew to space station going up. So there is a conflict of schedule. So the most likely is going to be later in October, and that's my bet when they'll roll out on the VAB. But once they got in the VAB, they can fix up a few things as well and just make sure everything is as good as they can get it.
On the Space Show, we're talking with Angelo Di Grazia for the Space Association of Australia. He is at the Kennedy Space Centre, rather disappointed at the moment. Well, Angelo, now that you've actually seen the SLS, what are your impressions?
Well, you know, I'm a rocket man from the 60s, and looking at any rocket is always impressive, but this is doubly impressive. It is a big rocket. It's got that same orange glow that the space shuttle had, and it's got these mighty solid rocket boosters attached to it, and it's got that really nice cute little top that, you know, curved top that you see on the rocket, which actually protects the Orion capsule during atmospheric launch. It's pretty impressive. I befriended a guy who was organising the media to go out to the pads every day to check their cameras and all the rest of it. And I was lucky enough to get a ride, not to the launch pad, but certainly around it. And it was awesome. The big impression for me, though, was the heat. The heat out here, it's midsummer and it's very oppressive and extremely humid. It's, you know, it's Cairns on a bad day. So the impressions of seeing our rocket, which are just awesome, and the heat really have a kind of a conflicting impression of my trip to the space coast.
Now, a little birdie whispered in my ear and told me that you had a brief chat with NASA Administrator Bill Nelson.
Well, I not only had a little chat, but I've actually got proof of that encounter in a picture that I'll be presenting when I do my report to the Space Association meeting in September. So, it was an interesting encounter because Bill Nelson occasionally would wander into the media centre, and, you know, sometimes there's a lot of media people in the room and sometimes there's not many. So, you know, on this occasion, there wasn't that many. And he was talking and I'm hanging on the edge there, and he looks at me and he says, "Well, how are you?" And so I said, "Yeah, I'm good," you know, with clearly the Australian accent, which clearly got his attention. So we had a little chat, and we moved across and we took some pictures and all that sort of stuff, and it was, you know, quite a thrill. I mean, Bill Nelson is the consummate politician. He was the one that was responsible, actually, him and another congresswoman, back in 2010, that mandated the NASA to build the SLS. So that was a thrill. That was a thrill.
Well, Angelo, thank you very much for joining us on the Space Show.
Yeah, my pleasure, Andrew. And unfortunately, I won't be here in October, but we'll certainly be watching it keenly on the TV, and hope this time it's a success and they're off to the moon.
Mm, okay. And I believe you're off to Boca Chica.
Yes. On Thursday morning, American time, I'm heading off to Houston. I'll spend a little bit of time in Houston, catch up with a few people that I know there. And then I'll do the 5.5 hour drive down to Boca Chica, do the 30-minute trip around the publicly accessible roads. But with a bit of luck, I'll get a few pictures of the rocket garden, and then I'll drive towards the beach and I'll get some pictures of the launch center, the launch complex. I'm hoping that Elon, during the next 3 days, doesn't blow up either the booster or Starship, but I know that they are testing it. They're doing spin tests and, some hot fire tests as well. So I'm really looking forward to that because apparently, when you see this rocket, it's something that's really out of this world, literally. So that'll be good. Yeah, and then I head back to Melbourne.
Right. Well, we look forward to more of your reports. Thank you, Angelo. It's Angelo De Grazia from the Space Association of Australia.